Hello, welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'd like to begin today with an article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal on the 26th of August. The title of the article is The Forgotten Part of MLK's Dream, Good Jobs and Higher Wages. At the March on Washington 60 years ago, King and other speakers demanded economic progress for Black Americans as a key to equality. 60 years ago, on August 28th of 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech on the Mall in Washington, D.C. We both vividly remember the day. Like millions of young Black Americans, we hung on every word of King's spellbinding oratory and hoped that his rhetoric would someday become our reality. So brilliantly did his speech succeed that many Americans remember little else from that day, almost as if the entire event had been staged simply to let America know that King had a dream. But dreams can be evanescent, and it is important to remember that his words were in service to a cause. The massive civil rights protest that went down in history as the March on Washington was officially called the March for Jobs and Freedom, and jobs were a big part of the agenda. Beneath the soaring rhetoric was a concrete hope that the private and public sectors working together would improve the economic picture for Black Americans. Six decades later, it is clear that we still have work to do. Civil rights were obviously important in a nation that generally regarded Black Americans as second-class citizens. Voting rights were suppressed throughout the South, and Black Americans dealt with hundreds of daily humiliations. As Americans commemorated the centennial of the Civil War, it was urgent to live up to long overdue promises of equal rights for all, to remind Americans of that moral debt in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial was highly effective political theater. But as King understood, and many speakers that day said overtly, political and civil rights could take Americans, Black Americans, only so far if they remained shut out of economic opportunity. King insisted that his dream was deeply rooted in the American dream, which meant a good education, decent housing, quality health care, and a realistic chance of getting a job that paid a living wage. Most of those promises were a long way from the daily experience of Black families in 1963. As King noted at that time, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. That was as true in that urban ghettos of the North as it was in the South. In recent decades, historians have revealed the pervasiveness of racial covenants, redlining, and predatory lending in northern cities that prided themselves on progressiveness. The result was depressed home ownership for Black Americans and a different form of segregation. Other speakers at the march went more deeply into the economic problem. The first speech of the day was given by one of the event's organizers, the redoubtable A. Philip Randolph, who had been advocating for such a march since 1941. Born in 1888, when Abraham Lincoln was still a living memory for many, Randolph devoted his life to the economic betterment of Black Americans. His advocacy led President Franklin Roosevelt to issue an executive order in 1941 that prohibited discrimination in the defense industry. Throughout World War II, Randolph argued passionately that patriotic Black Americans should be given the same chance to work for and to defend their country as all other citizens. And in a country devoted to equality, they should be paid at similar rates. Two decades later, Randolph was still making the same argument. As he explained to the huge crowd gathered for the march, the goal was not merely the passage of civil rights legislation. It was also to secure the economic stability that would make those rights worth having. Yes, we want all public accommodations open to all citizens, he said, but those accommodations will mean little to those who cannot afford to use them. Randolph never surrendered his hopes for economic betterment. In the years that followed, he, King, and Rayard Rustin worked on a document they called the Freedom Budget. When it was finally issued in January of 1967, it was clear that it's called for guaranteed employment was farther than Congress was willing to go, especially with the growing cost of the Vietnam War. But the Johnson administration's effort to reduce poverty clearly owed a great deal to the economic argument that had been voiced by King and his fellow civil rights leaders. And just as Black Americans had contributed meaningfully to the war effort in World War II, so they contributed to the long boom of the 1960s as economic barriers slowly and imperfectly receded. To the end of his life, King addressed the economic challenges facing Black Americans. And during his final days in Memphis, he was talking about creative new approaches to financial challenges, including better banking and insurance options. In 1966, he wrote, "Jobs are harder to create than voting rolls," and warned his followers that they should be wary of short-term victories that were emotionally satisfying but materially deficient. Instead, they should keep their eyes on the results that mattered: jobs, housing, and education. Decades later, it's important to remember King's economic dream and to realize how distant it remains. Even in a time of general prosperity, Black unemployment remains too high, and there are substantial disparities in other economic categories as well, including median income, home ownership, and family wealth. In 2019, the median Black family had $23,000 in family wealth, compared to $184,000 for the median white family. In 2020, median income was roughly $46,000 for Black workers, compared to $75,000 for white workers. Many of these disparities have remained essentially the same since King's lifetime. In 2022, the Treasury Department issued a report on racial inequality in the United States, arguing that racial inequality holds back all Americans. As Deputy Treasury Secretary Wally Ademio put it, "The exclusion of communities of color from the ladder of economic opportunity holds back economic growth for the entire country." A logical inference is that addressing this inequality head-on will spread dividends to all sectors. As King understood it, there is a business argument as well as a moral argument for strengthening Black prosperity. It boosts growth across the entire economy, increases investment in new businesses, stimulates innovation, and builds consumer confidence. And while government programs can help, business remains the chief source of economic opportunity in this country. We are heartened by the fact that most major companies have expressed a commitment to diversity, including improved employment opportunities for Black Americans. We would ask companies not only to keep that commitment, but to accelerate it with the goal of building a thriving economy that benefits all Americans. As King understood it, economic inclusiveness is also very good for the larger cause of helping Americans live up to the full promise of our democracy. Moved by the sight of America's racial diversity on that day in August 1963, he praised his white brothers for realizing that their freedom is inextricably tied up with our freedom. Continuing the thought, he added, "We cannot walk alone." That remains true all these years later for each of us. By walking together, perhaps we can do more to remember and realize the full reach of King's dream. This article was written for the Journal by Ken Chenault and Ken Frazier. The next article that I would like to read for you also appeared in the Wall Street Journal, December 27th. This article is entitled, "U.S. Ski Resorts Are Hotspots for Jobs." The article was written for the Journal by Bob Fernandez. Despite rate rises and global warming, employment tops pre-pandemic levels. Warming temperatures and less reliable snowfall hit ski slopes hard in some regions this year. Hundreds of runs closed, with abandoned lifts snaking through forests. But overall, Gen Xers, millennials, and still skiing young baby boomers stormed the slopes after the pandemic lockdowns. Add to that big snows in parts of the West, perhaps related to El Nino weather patterns and cranked up snowmaking machines in the Northeast, and ski resort jobs have climbed to levels never seen before in the U.S. Federal Reserve rate increases put a chill in the labor market. But U.S. ski resorts are hot pockets of employment, with monthly job numbers running 15% to 26% higher this year than in 2022. Even in the summer, when resorts cater to families and warm weather outdoorsy adventurers. Arizona, New Mexico, Southern Colorado, and the Sierra Nevadas in California have been drier than in the past, but in Northern Colorado, the Steamboat ski area last year got 428 inches of snowfall, or about 50% more than the average over the past decade, with almost 100 days of fresh snow. Going back to the 30s, if you have a lot of snow, you have a lot of skiers, said Michael Childers, associate professor at Colorado State University and author of Colorado Powder Keg, Ski Resorts and the Environmental Movement. At some resorts, the ski season extends into April because of shifting weather patterns, Childers said. Condos, second homes, and ancillary development at ski resorts have turned a lot of these areas into suburban sprawl, Childers said. The snow is late in coming in any real measure, but folks are still heading up every weekend and facing long lift lines, he said. Ski facilities are putting tons of money into new trails and higher capacity lifts, as well as financing some employee lodging in pricey resort towns. Companies recruit in South America for seasonal hires. Alterra Mountain, which owns properties in the U.S. and Canada, said in March that it has put $1 billion into its facilities in recent years and expected to invest an additional $500 million in lifts, snowmaking, summer adventures, and infrastructure this year. Alterra Mountain owns facilities in Colorado, California, Vermont, West Virginia, Washington, and Utah. $50 million in new employee housing projects added 500 workforce housing beds for the season, an Alterra Mountain representative said. In mid-December, Aspen Mountain in Colorado opened 153 acres to skiers with a new lift higher up the mountain as part of a $13.8 million expansion, the first big one since the late 80s. The post-pandemic boom in outdoor sports does not seem to be slowing down. We pretty much have our foot on the gas, said Aspen Mountain spokesperson Jeff Haney. Millennials and Gen Xers have participated in greater numbers, and the younger cohort of baby boomers are not exiting the sport as quickly as we thought they would, Melanie Mills, chief executive of Colorado Ski Country, the state's trade association, said earlier this year. Ski jobs peak in the coldest months. In January, ski resort employment hit 96,600, not seasonally adjusted, up 23% from the year earlier, 78,800, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In January of 2020, before the pandemic lockdown began, the figure was 85,200. In October, the latest month for which data is available, ski resorts employed 20,400 people, which was up from 24,700 a year earlier. The hospitality sector has been slow to recover from the pandemic, with jobs nearly flat compared with pre-pandemic times. Looking to tame inflation, the Fed cooled the economy with 11 rate increases. Monetary policy actions, though, can neither change weather patterns nor dim the passion of skiers and snowboarders when it snows. The following article is from the Wall Street Journal, the 2nd of January. This article was written by Austin Hufford, and the title is Workers Gain Ground, Blunting Effect of Rising Minimum Wages. Low-paid workers might not notice that 22 states are increasing the minimum wage to start the year. The reason robust raises in recent years have rendered pay floors largely irrelevant, even in states that aggressively lifted them. At the turn of each year, many states lift the minimum wage to adjust for the cost of living or to meet requirements in the law. Before the pandemic, that often meant a welcomed raise for low-wage workers, but labor shortages in recent years caused paychecks for many cooks, housekeepers, and grocery clerks to rise faster than required by states. Meanwhile, the $7.25 an hour federal minimum wage followed in 20 states has been unchanged since 2009. To start 2024, Washington State is going to raise the nation's highest minimum to $16.28 an hour from $15.74 in 2023. Washington ties its minimum wage to the Consumer Price Index, a measure of inflation. Hawaii has the largest planned increase, with its minimum wage rising $2 to $14 an hour in 2024. That is part of a law that will increase the lowest hourly wages in the Aloha State to $18 by 2028. California, New York, and Illinois also are among the states raising the pay floor. Most low-wage workers are making well above those minimums. Through September, the lowest 10% of workers by income in each state earned hourly wages that were on average nearly 50% higher than their state's minimum wages in 2023, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis that compared state minimum wages to income estimates from MIT Sloan School of Management professor Nathan Wilmers. That is the largest gap between actual pay and minimum pay in a decade. Because of inflation, Colorado's state minimum hourly wage is increasing to $14.42 at the start of 2024, up from $13.65 in 2023. Even with the raise, most low-wage Colorado workers will earn well more. The 10th percentile worker in the state made an average of $16 an hour for the first 9 months of 2023, up from $15.30 in 2022. At a machine shop in Broomfield, Colorado, the only employee getting a direct raise owing to the minimum wage increase will be the part-time high school intern. Our pay scale does not rely on minimum wage, said Andrew Ege, who is general manager of the machine shop EPTAM Rapid Launch Center. We plan on that intern wage by a dollar or so. When David Aaron started as a machinist in 2018 at a different shop, he earned that same $15 he received working at a local pizza joint. Now, at EPTAM, he is making around $30 an hour. Aaron attributes the growth to learning new skills, a strong work ethic, and a shortage of wannabe machinists. He recently started saving to buy a home. There is pretty much always an opening, Aaron said. They have been mid-year raises. They knew that the market is competitive. Nationally, the 10% lowest earning workers saw a 4.8% raise in the third quarter from a year earlier, according to the Labor Department. That is almost half as strong as the prior year, but still outpaces inflation and the increase in the minimum wage in the states that tie the pay floor to prices. Consumer prices in September rose 3.7% from the year earlier, and inflation has cooled further since. Really tight labor markets are better for people at the bottom. When times are really good, they catch up, said David Newmark, who is an economics professor at the University of California, Irvine. The country is split between states with lower and higher minimum wages. Of the 30 states with a minimum wage above the federal level, most adjust the level annually, and 17 states mandate $12 or more an hour. Meanwhile, inflation and wage increases have effectively erased the federal minimum. In 2022, only about 1 million workers made $7 and a quarter or less an hour, roughly 1% of the workforce, according to the Labor Department. Some argue that pay rates for the low-wage workers that outstrip minimums show the market can set fair wages without government intervention. Others say the recent bout of elevated inflation shows why pay floors need regular increases. Over the past decades, unions and workers' advocates successfully pushed for many states and cities to raise their minimum wages to $15 an hour. And now some want to go even further, with at least one union pushing to double the former Fight for 15 goal. And to close for today, a question and answer from WorkFriend by Roxanne Gay. Should you exercise on a video call? The question. Every other week, our work group has a standing Teams call. We have our cameras on. Inevitably, one of our colleagues is getting in their workout during our call by walking on a treadmill. You can see only the top part of his body, which rocks back and forth. It's very distracting, and some of us find it rude. Should we say anything to him or to our boss? From Anonymous. The answer from Roxanne Gay is, I'm not clear. Is your colleague literally working out, or is he working from a treadmill desk? If he's working out, that is atypical and inappropriate. It is your manager's job to clearly dictate expectations for remote work and to ensure that the team is meeting those expectations. I would start by saying something to your colleagues before escalating it to your boss. Hopefully, he will concede the point and show up to meetings in a more appropriate manner. If your colleague is working from a treadmill desk, some flexibility may be in order. Treadmill desks are a relatively new phenomenon, but they aren't particularly rare. Some people like staying active while working, and there are many health benefits as well to walking while working. If your colleague is actively engaged, appropriately attired, and simply walking during the meeting, let him be. In the grand scheme of things, this is not such a big deal. This is all we have time for on our program on careers today. Thank you for listening in, and enjoy the rest of your day. I'm Irene Lubin. I'm a volunteer reader, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.